Ladies and gentlemen, Jimmy Floyd Hasselbaink, welcome to the show, buddy.
Football was my everything. I was hanging out with the wrong people. I thought I was the man, but I wasn't. Majority of these guys are all dead. So yes, football did save me. I had one negotiation with him on contract. We fell out. We fell out really big time. They wanted me out in a way that I look bad.
Normally now when we talk about football and say 300 a week, 200 a week, we mean 300 grand, right?
Yeah, no, forget that. No, I wish. But there were so many problems at the club. The owner went to jail. They bought me from Leeds for 12 million quid and they sold me to Chelsea for 15 million quid. And at the time, that was the highest transfer in the Premier League. What people forget is we also have wives at home. We need to eat. We need to pay the bills. Black or white, he doesn't look at me like that. And I know that. I'm open. I'm honest. Yeah, I see myself as a good bloke. I've turned out okay.
Guys, Matt Haycock's here, and welcome to another episode of The Matt Haycock Show, where today I have got footballing legend, star striker. He's played for Leeds United, Chelsea, Atletico Madrid. He's now coaching the England team. Ladies and gentlemen, Jimmy Floyd Hasselbaink.
Hi, guys.
I was going to say that even with my absolute non-existent lack of football knowledge, yours is a name that even I know.
Oh,
I mean, it's funny, today, you know, you always see like names on shirts and stuff, and you know, people going crazy. And even, you know, when I'm on the internet or reading the newspapers, I haven't got a clue who any of these people are. But you know, being from Leeds, growing up in Leeds, your name was a name that was always bandied around by my friends.
Yeah, no, Leeds, that is where it really started, you know, for me. Yes, I did play professional before.
I tell you what, just before you tell me about the football and professional, let's just rewind to when you were a kid and how your actual interest in football began and what you're up to. Because
I think you were
a bit of a naughty boy in your day as well, weren't you?
I was. That was just the area that I was living in. That is not an excuse. It's still wrong. But you get exposed to it. And I wasn't strong enough to stay out of that. So
were you from like a poor area or a poor family?
Yeah, very, very, very poor. Very poor. My mom was by herself to raising all the kids. She had to work. So majority of the time, my sister and my brother were looking after me. You get a lot of free time and you lot of time outside and all that kind of stuff. So my brother who is 3 years older than me, he was always playing football. And I always wanted to do the same thing that my brother was doing. And I was always following him. So it was because of him that I really got into football.
And when you say got into it, I mean, you were playing at school, you were playing in local teams? Or
yeah. First of all, I always had a ball under my arm. If I weren't with friends, I was by myself playing with the ball. And at school all the time, I played at school with other guys, and I was in the school team. The school team was quite successful. I think we went to a tournament where we end up being, I think, sixth in the whole country. Football was my everything. So I was quite late becoming a professional footballer. I end up playing, my brother as well became a professional footballer. I end up playing for 1 year with my brother in the same team at AZ.
This is back in Holland.
This is back in Holland, yeah. It was actually quite strange because at that time I was a right midfielder, right winger, and so was my brother. Yeah, so we were in a way
competing
for one spot. I was then released from that club, and I went. I went to the non-leagues again. And from the non-league, I went to Portugal, where in the non-league in Holland, an agent called Humphrey Nijman, who became my agent for the rest of my career, got me a trial in Portugal at Campo Maiorense. First, actually, he got me a trial in Austria. And the club didn't want me. I got a trial in Campo Maiorense in Portugal, in the smallest town ever. I think there was like, 20, 30,000 people living in that town. I did well. They offered me a contract. And now out of a sudden from non-league, 2 weeks, 3 weeks later, I was playing in the highest division in Portugal. Yeah, that's how crazy it can be in football.
And I heard as well, did you start off as a goalkeeper?
When I was... That's the thing. When you're younger, when you're like 7, 8, and you want to play with... you want to play 5-a-side or 6-a-side with your brother's friends, yeah? They're going to put you in the place where they don't want to be, you know? And for you to still participate, you have to take it. And that was goal. You know, so I started there. And
Is it really a position that no one wants to be in? I mean, I know when I play my silly five-a-side, you know, like nobody ever wants to be in goal. I mean, is it just because you want to be out there running, or is it because the ball hurts too much when you get hit?
95% of football players, or kids who want to be football players, they don't want to be in a goal, do they? Goalkeepers, I have got the utmost respect for them, because it is a really tough job. The work and the training that they do is just, you've got no idea how hard they train. And mentally, you have to be so strong, because it's a different world.
You're getting the blame, I guess, aren't you?
Well, not only that, you're quite a lot by yourself. You know, they always say that goalkeepers are different kind of species, you know. But majority of footballers, they want to be or kids, they want to be or the strikers or the number 10, you know.
Is it harder? I mean, if you want to be a goalie, is it harder to be one just because there's only one? Whereas, okay, you might want to be a striker, but you could still be a defender or midfielder or something.
Yeah. In a way, yes. The best goalkeepers are the ones that from day one that they wanted to be a goalkeeper, and also the best goalkeepers are ones that can't really play football that well.
I mean, I was going to say, can they kick a ball well, or are some of them really shit?
I wouldn't say shit. I've only played with a few goalkeepers that could play, you know, the outfield positions. One was Edwin van der Sar. He was just amazing. The other one was Carlo Codicini. He could easily, you know, play as a fullback or whatsoever. But then if you look at De Gui or Bosnić or Schwarzer, you know, who are all absolutely magnificent goalkeepers, you wouldn't put them center half or right back or whatsoever, you know? They wouldn't be able to do that. So it is a specialized position that needs different kind of qualities.
So just going back to when you were starting, so you got your first professional contract.
Yeah.
Had you left the kind of gang life behind by then, or was there any crossover?
Well, that was gone, well gone.
I mean, was there ever a time when you could have gone down a very wrong path? I mean, did football help you make the right direction?
Well, I went in a way in a wrong path. I was hanging out with the wrong people. We were doing things that we shouldn't do, you know. And of course, it could have been bad. Majority of these guys, are or dead now, and are living a very difficult life. You know, there was only one, and that's my best mate. And we became professional footballers, you know.
He's still your best mate now?
He's still my best mate now, yeah. And he's an agent now. So he became a professional footballer in Holland. I became a professional footballer and I moved out. And I think that was the best thing that could happen to me on when I was 23, just to be on my own and concentrate on football. So yes, football did save me.
And what did it feel like, you know, that first day, you know, playing your first professional match, you know, on the field in front of the fans?
Well, that started obviously when I was 17. That was 17. And what a feeling. That's what you're doing for. But when I was 17, I thought, oh, I've made it.
I was going to say, did you feel like you'd made it, or did you know it was the beginning of the journey?
No, I thought I made it. I was earning. I was still living at home. I was earning something like £250 a week. And I thought I made it. Yeah. I could help my mom with a little bit of groceries and stuff. I turn up at training whenever I wanted. I thought I was the man, but I wasn't. Once again, I was late on training, and I was dismissed, and I could go back home, and my contract was terminated. So that was a big lesson for me.
Did you worry it could have been the end?
Well, in a way, I was lucky because I had that much potential that AZ Alkmaar straight away offered me a place. So I went from Telstar to AZ Alkmaar, where I got an opportunity. And but my brother was at AZ Alkmaar. So we were going to training together. And my luck was, my brother was a lot more serious than I was at the time. A lot more better with timekeeping and stuff. So my brother, in a way, took me under the wing. That I was never late. That I was professional and all that kind of stuff. So, so I got a 2-year contract. And then after 2 years, the manager didn't fancy me. So from that moment, I was released and I had to go back to non-league. And I was still living at my parents, at my mom's house. But now I am at non-league, and I need another job. So I was working in a bakery to get extra money. So I have to wake up like really early to get to the bakery to make sure that the bread is ready. And in the afternoon, late, I'm training 2-3 times a week because it's non-league. And on a Saturday you play. And thank God, one day, an agent called Humphrey Nyman spots me. I said, look, listen, I've got a couple of contacts and they're looking for a striker. What do you think? And I was open for it. So first, I was sent to Austria. Didn't work out, came back. And then the second one was Portugal, Campo Maiorense. And I had a good trial, and they offered me a contract. And now, out of a sudden, I'm playing in the highest league, you know, in Portugal, all by myself, very coincidental. At the time, my girlfriend was pregnant with my first. And that was 27 years ago, you know? So and that is where it kicked off. And that is where I was by myself. I could had to concentrate on football. There were no distractions. And I think that year, Camp Mariners went down, but I scored 14 goals, and I had quite a good season. And from there, end of the season, I was now out of a sudden sold by Camp Mariners to Boa Vista for, at the time, 300 grand.
Was that big money back then?
In Portugal, yeah.
What kind of wages were you earning at that time?
I was at Camp Mayor. I was on, I think, something like 10 grand a month, something like that. So 2.5 grand a week.
That was reasonably normal?
In Portugal, yes. For me, no.
Oh, yeah.
For me, that was big money.
Yeah.
Because my contract at Leeds and AZ were like 200, 250 at Telstar and at AZ maybe 300, 350 a week. So to now out of a sudden, and then when I had to go to the non-league.
Just to be clear, that's pounds, because I never...
Yeah, more or less.
No, sorry, I mean not hundreds of... Because normally now when we talk about football and say 300 a week, 200 a week, we mean 300 grand, right?
Yeah, no, forget that. No, that was not... But I wish, no. No, but... But what I'm not saying is, I was I had to go back to non-league, and you were getting a little bit of expenses and all that kind of stuff. But I was really working at a bread factory in a bakery, really, yeah. So I was earning peanuts, yeah. So for me now to go from that to that. Yeah. And earning out of a sudden 130, 140 grand a year, that was massive for me. So and then being sold to Boa Vista, and yeah, there you earn more, a lot more, because now out of a sudden in one and a bit years, I'm playing for, I think, the fourth, fifth biggest club in Portugal. Yeah. We are playing in Europe in the UEFA Cup against Inter Milan and all them kind of clubs. And I'm earning now three times, four times more than my Campo Maiorense contract. So, and that is in really a year's time. Yeah. So,
and you had a good run at Boa Vista. You scored 20 goals in 29 games.
Yeah, me and Nuno Gomes were playing up front, and we were like scoring for fun together. We had Russell Latapy behind us, Erwin Sanchez. So we were on fire. We were on fire, and I think that year I scored like something like 27 goals in total, and we won the cup, the Portuguese cup we won, and then Leeds came.
And how did that come about? Were you looking for a move, or did they come?
No, I had a 3-year contract. I had a 3-year contract, and that was just my first year. I wasn't looking at a move. My agent, later on when I found out, my agent had contacts in England. He had contacts with this scout who was called Ian McNeil, who has passed away. He was a Scottish guy who was working for a few clubs. One of those clubs was Leeds, who he had a really good relationship with Josh Graham. Josh Graham had just taken over at Leeds that year, where Leeds were at the bottom of the league, more or less, and he came in and saved them and got them to the 11th spot. But he wanted to totally renew the team. So my agent said to Ian McNeil, look, you need to follow this boy I have in Portugal. He's doing absolutely well. Go and see him, you know, go and scout him, go and follow him. Don't follow him one or two matches, but follow him 5-6. So Ian McNeil flew over a few times and saw me play. And then he went to Josh Graham and said to Josh Graham, look, I've seen this boy there and there, you know, I think you need to come in and see him. At the end of the season, more or less, we were playing Victoria Setúbal. I won't forget this. Josh Graham was on the in the stand watching the game. I had a really good game. I think I scored. And in the opposite team, there was a guy called Bruno Ribeiro. And he had a very good game. So Josh Graham came over to see me, but he caught also Bruno Ribeiro. So then at the end of the season, we played the Portuguese Cup. I was on the bench for the Cup. Josh Graham was again on the bench. My agent told me that. I thought, shit, I'm on the bench. He's not going to, he's not going to take me because I'm on the bench. He can't see me. I came in the last 20, 25 minutes. We won.
Did you score?
No, I didn't score. We won. And straight after the game, or straight a week after the game, they put a bid in for me and it was accepted. And they also took Bruno Ribeiro from Victoria Setúbal. They bought me for $2 million.
And that was massive money back then, right?
Well, it was substantial. It was substantial. It was not the biggest transfer, but it was substantial for somebody that nobody knew.
You were on $2,500 a week at Boa Vista?
I was on substantial more.
Can you tell us what?
It becomes bigger figures now. So I was on good money. And then obviously when I signed at least, don't get me wrong, even at Campinense it's good money. And then when I signed for Leeds, it was good money as well. You know, not the biggest, because still nobody knew me. But it was, I could buy a house, you know, what I did.
Where did you buy your first Leeds house?
In Old Woodley.
Oh, was it the one we were talking about?
That was my first house.
My neighbor. My neighbor who we didn't know.
Yes, exactly. I love that house in Leeds.
Give me a few Leeds anecdotes for my friends. You know, what did you think to Leeds? What was it like to hang out there, party there?
Mate, I loved it, mate. I loved it. Leeds, one city club. So everybody knows you because everybody, well, 98% of Leeds, people who live in Leeds are Leeds fans. So I had honestly a magnificent time. We were always on a Saturday out, you know.
Were you eating the flying pizza?
It was Mondays, wasn't it?
Well, it was most of, but certainly Thursdays and Fridays.
Thursdays and Fridays. Well, Thursdays you wouldn't see me because Saturday game, Friday also not. The restaurant actually, the food was okay. Yeah. But the atmosphere was so good.
Well, the thing as well that people don't appreciate, at least people don't appreciate from back then, is in 1997, 98, there were no other restaurants to go to.
No.
And also certainly out of the city centre. If you didn't want to go to the city centre, there was nowhere to go to. Yeah. So, yeah, anyone with money, anyone who wanted to be near anyone with money was hanging out in
pizza.
There.
Yeah.
So I've got to tell you, so in 1997, when you were eating your dinner in the Flying Pizza, having been transferred for £2 million, I was doing my first job. And I was a magician in the Flying Pizza.
Magician?
Honestly. And you know what they paid me? They paid me a fucking garlic bread. Honestly,
you must have been a very good magician.
Adriano said, because I knew him, I mean, I went to the Flying Pizza. I had my first birthday in the Flying Pizza.
Oh, gosh.
Literally, I've still got a picture at home, me sat eating sucking a mushroom pizza in a high chair at the Flying Pizza. Went there all through my childhood, and I used to have magic as a hobby. Yeah. Was desperate to be a famous magician. You know, I used to want to be David Copperfield, and I went to Adriano and said, "Can I, can I come and work here?" And he was kind of wanting to be polite, but basically saying no. And you know, I'm not going to pay you because obviously it was very tight anyway. And I basically agreed to come to work for free. I said, "I'll just do it for tips." He said, "Okay, fine. You come and work for tips." And after my first night of being there, he said he felt guilty and he had to give me something. I'm thinking maybe he's going to give me a tenner. He said, "What kind of pizza do you want?" I was like, "Well, I'll have a garlic bread."
And that became
every Friday night, every Saturday night. That was my weekly wage, but I was earning £200, £300 in tips from the customers, and some of the waiters who we used to be waiters when I was working there are still waiters today. And yeah, I'm going back. You know, we're talking 25 years later. I still go and eat. I take my kids in there, and it's funny. I was said to my daughter recently. You know, he used to work here when I was there, and I was saying to the guy, tell Harley, and he said, we all used to hate your dad because
you used to take my tips.
Yeah, we were getting 30 quid in tips, and this like little 16-year-old was getting £200, £300.
No, that was an iconic place, and it was not too far from where I lived.
Mm-hmm.
So it was easy to get to. It was always heaving. It was always, it was always busy. I always had a table. Never had to really wait for a table. Adriano was very smart.
Well, he was a massive football fan as well, Adriano, wasn't he?
He was very smart at that because he wanted the least players in there to get the hype even more. I loved Leeds. I still do. It hurts me that they are not in the Premier League now. The Premier League is not the same without Leeds. That stadium, Elland Road, those fans, they need to be in the Premier League. Hopefully these new owners that they have now are really serious people and do the business really, really well. And invest in the squad properly.
When you were there, was that the Ridsdale era, or were you just before?
So, when I signed, it was not Ridsdale; it was somebody else.
Was it Ken Bates?
No. It was the PLP. I don't know the name anymore. But then the year later, Peter Ridsdale took over. So I had a year with Peter Ridsdale.
And I mean, again, as a non-football person, the stuff I remember from then was the talk of extravagant spending and, Ridsdale came in and if you could pay £50 instead of £10, he'd want to pay £100, you know?
I was gone. So the year that he took over, so I had 1 year with him. I had one negotiation with him on contract. We fell out really big time. And I felt that he done me with David O'Leary.
Done you in what way? As in you didn't want to work with O'Leary or done you over money?
Well, on both. I think I was George Graham's man, wasn't I? George Graham's protege, in a way. George Graham came to see me in Portugal. He took me on. He thought that I was good, and I was his project. Yeah. So when he brought me over, I was his signing, really. David Oliva was the assistant. And I really played for George Graham. Really, after games, George Graham used to hammer me or give me love, or what was rarely, because George Graham is not the kind of person to give you too much love. You know, he wants to have you always on your toes. And then when George Graham left to Spurs, things changed. Yeah.
And that, so he left, O'Leary became manager.
O'Leary became manager.
So you had one season under one season under the other?
No, I had one and a bit season under George Graham. And then mid-season, more or less, he left. And David O'Leary took over and became the manager. And then Eddie Gray became the assistant.
And, I mean, was it a particularly big difference in management style, or was it just that you and O'Leary had personal friction?
It's always difficult for an assistant to take over and now out of a sudden becomes the manager. It's not easy, because when you're assistant, players look different at you and say different things, and just their body language is different. And
you don't respect them as much.
No, you do respect them, but they have got a different role. They're not the boss, are they? Mm-hmm. You are different to the boss. Everybody is, you know. So you have a different kind of relationship with the assistant than you have with the boss. So my relationship with David was all right, but I'm Dutch and I wear my heart on my sleeves, you know, and I will say things, not disrespectfully, but I will say the truth. And that might sometimes go in the wrong way, while I don't mean it disrespectfully, you know. And that might have happened. I don't know. I'm just assuming here. That might have happened with David Louis. And he wanted to bring the youngsters through. He had his own vision, really. Yeah. So, and that is rightly so. He's the manager now. I am George Graham's bye. I will never be David O'Leary's bye. So if I do really well on the David O'Leary, I'm still George Graham bye. He's not gonna get the credit. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we now having negotiations for a new contract, because I signed 4 years and I had 2 years left. And they wanted to protect their asset, obviously. And when you have got 2 years left, that is the time to start talking about a new contract. And I wanted to stay. Until this day, I'm telling you, I wanted to stay. I never thought of leaving Leeds United. That tells you how much fun and how much I loved it there. I did not really want to go. Not at all. So what happened was, we had negotiations. They made an offer. I said no, because that was not the market rate for somebody that has just become an international player, yeah, and played for the Dutch national team, went to the World Cup. And on top of that, that year where we started negotiations, won the Golden Boot. I was top scorer that year. Yep. And no other Leeds striker for a long time has become top scorer. Yeah? So I said, just pay the market rate. You know, just as everybody in business or in football would say, you know? And they were far from it. Far from it.
And this is an O'Leary decision or a Ridsdale or a bit of both?
I will never know. But the negotiations, well, I would think that it is an O'Leary decision because end of the day, in those days, definitely the manager decides what happens, you know. So now, I'm saying I'm not going to sign this.
And you think, I mean, given that O'Leary, given that Ridsdale went on to spend like an absolute lunatic
after that,
yeah. do you think that this was probably O'Leary's way of getting rid of you without getting rid of you?
I'm going to get there. Right. And I'm going to get there. So, what they done is, okay, if you're not signing, we are not going to play you. So I'm saying, I'm not signing. I can't sign for this. Yeah, but we need to. We can't, you know. You have to sign this. So I'm saying I'm not signing this. I want this, and I want this in the contract. That's not going to happen, Jimmy. That's not going to happen. Well, then you need to leave, they said. Then I leave. So now all of a sudden, Chelsea comes in for me. Yeah, but we're not selling you for to an English club. And if you want to go, then you have to ask for a transfer request. But I don't want to go. I don't want to go. Yeah, but you have to ask for a transfer request if you. I don't want to go. Yeah, but then you need to sign. No, I'm not going to sign. Yeah, but then we're going to sell you. I said, okay.
And why did they make you ask for a transfer request? Is that to make you look bad in front of the fans?
So here it comes. If you're going to go, you need to ask for a transfer request. Yeah, but then I lose all my signing on fees. Why would I ask for a transfer request? A, I don't want to go. A, I want to stay here. And B, you know, I don't want to lose my transfer request. So here it comes. So Jimmy, you know what? You asked for a transfer request. We signed a paper that you won't lose your signing on fees. Yeah? So this is going on for quite a while behind the scenes. So I'm getting fed up, yeah, of the whole thing, knowing they don't want me here.
And you're not playing at this point either.
I'm only playing. This was still preseason. I'm playing preseason matches, and I'm getting stick right, left, right, and center from the Leeds fans. Yeah, because they don't know the full story. So I sign the transfer request. Yeah, the moment I sign the transfer request, not a word of a lie. 5 minutes after, it's on Sky Sport News that I want to go and I've asked for a transfer request. While that is not the story. Yeah. So, because also, if I ask for a transfer request, yeah, I won't get my signing on fees. I got my signing on fees when I left. So that tells me they wanted me out. And they wanted me out in a way that I looked bad. Not that they were selling me. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because if they would have done it a different way, they would have had the stick from the Leeds fans, because I was liked, I was loved. Yeah. So now I'm the villain. And that's how it happened. And that's how I fell out with Ridsdale, because he made me look bad and me like that I didn't want to be there. While that was not the case. So then I end up going to Atletico Madrid because they didn't want to sell me to Leeds. Played a year at Atletico Madrid. And then when I came back to Leeds, we played... Chelsea, we played Leeds in the league. And I was on the pitch and Ridsdale came to me and wanted to shake my hands. And he asked, are you going to shake my hands? And that is where I was wrong. And with a lot of experience now in football, I know now that things, business is business.
You refuse to shake his hand.
So I refused to shake his hand. And I had a few words. What was wrong? what I should have never done. Yeah, it felt good at the moment, but it was wrong.
Who won that match, by the way, between Chelsea and
Leeds? Chelsea lost. And I had a horrific time. But anyway, in that match. So until this day, I feel quite sad about that, how I had to leave Leeds. And I had a really, I loved it in Yorkshire and Leeds, and the club, everything was brilliant there.
Has there ever been any opportunities in your managing and coaching career to go back to Leeds?
No, never. I tried once to become applied for a managerial job, but it never really materialized. So, Leeds is a magnificent club, and coming back to Richdale, I made up years after. We made up. We had a good chat. We had a good laugh. I end up playing for one of his clubs against Cardiff. Here and there, we still speak. So in that sense, we have made up and we have moved on.
So you went from Atletico, you went to Chelsea.
Yeah.
Big money signing fee or big wages?
At the time, was the highest transfer
ever
in the Premier League with Alan Shearer at the time. So a lot of pressure, and especially how I left the country with Leeds, and then coming back, all those media guys were straight away on top of me, and I was under pressure. But I handled it well. We didn't do that great as a team. I think we finished sixth, but I won the Golden Boot, scored 23 goals that year, and personally, I had a good year.
So are you one of the? Are there many people who've had two golden boots?
I think there are a few. I think there are nine of us. Oh. Two or more. I think there are nine of us, yes.
And so when you went to Atletico, did you always know that you'd be coming back to the English Premiership?
No. I signed 4 years.
So when I say no, let's say, did you always want to come back?
There was always going to be, okay, I'm going to play 2-3 years here, and then I'm going to try to get back to England, because the Premier League is the football in Spain is totally different than it is in the Premier League. Premier League is more physical, quicker, you know, more high intensity and that kind of stuff. That is more in my kind of way how I play. But then overall, you make plans in football, they don't always work out. So I had a magnificent year at Atletico Madrid, but there were so many problems at the club. Certain players were not getting paid. The owner went to jail, Jesus Gil. The club was in administration, and we went down. And the club couldn't afford me when they were going to go in their championship. So they had to sell me. They bought me from Leeds for 12 million quid, and they sold me to Chelsea for 15 million quid. And at the time, that was the highest transfer in the Premier League. So, it was not not easy, but a lot of pressure. But, you know, end of the day, that's what you want. You want to play at the highest level. You want to play in the best stadiums. And that comes with pressure.
And during your time at Chelsea, Abramovich bought in. You were there both sides, like pre-Abramovich and post-Abramovich. Yeah. I mean, did you get to witness, the start of his big spending?
Yeah, it was totally different because I got signed by Chelsea with the remit. Okay, we want to become champions, and at that time there was a lot of money to spend in my first year. Second and third, the money dried up a bit at Chelsea, and they were flirting with administration problems. In my third year, they wanted to sell me because they needed to raise money, and Barcelona came in for me, and that deal went almost through. But then the manager at Barcelona got sacked, and then the deal stopped. So then out of a sudden in my third year, in the summer, Ida Good Johnson calls me and said, did you hear the club is being taken over? It's being bought over by a Russian guy. Then pre-season, we have a meeting with Ranieri, and Ranieri tells us everything is going to change. There are lots of players gonna come in. The new guy wants to play for winning the league and playing for winning the Champions League and stuff. That year was our first year that we were in the Champions League. Then out of a sudden the preseason starts, and out of a sudden you have got lots of players coming in. Players like Joe Cole, Hernan Crespo, Mutu, Juan Sebastian Ferron, Damien Duff, Wayne Bridge, who more? A lot of players coming, and out of a sudden now the team is a lot stronger, and now out of a sudden you have a lot of competition for your place. And Ranieri knocks on my door again, even though Ranieri I knew from Atletico Madrid. He was my manager there. He came to Chelsea, was my manager for 3 years, had a lot of trouble with a few players that were in his first and second year. He knocks on my door in the third year, where he has got a lot of money to spend. And now he's saying, Jim, I'm going to get two strikers in. And I think that they are going to be better than you. You can have the choice of going or staying. And he had that same conversation with Ida Good Johnson, knowing that we were the best couple for him for years, scoring 55 goals in a season and stuff, and doing the business for him and got him into Champions League, but not really had the decency to give us in his mind a go. So had that conversation with him. I said to him, no, I don't want to go. I will stay. I will fight for my place. I'll show you that I'm still the number one. And Ida Good Johnson said the same. So at the beginning, the first few games, Hernan Crespo wasn't ready yet. I played up front with Adrian Mutu. Ida Good Johnson was on the bench quite a bit. I had a good start. I had a very good start. Crespo became fit. Then I became out of the team. Crespo didn't really work out. Needed a lot longer to settle in. Ranieri then became to get under pressure. Had needed to start winning games. And then he reverted back to me and Idagu Johnson when he needed to win games. And we were in the best team, in the best 11. We started, we played in the semi-final. In the quarter-final against Arsenal in the Champions League. We got through. We were now in the semi-final again. We were in the semi-final against Monaco. We should have won that game. I was on the bench. He put me in as a right winger. What is everybody know that is not my position. And we got knocked out. And that was the time really that we could win our first Champions League, because with all due respect, we should have won against Monaco and then against Porto in the final. You would think that we would win as well. But it wasn't meant to be. That year, I end up being Chelsea's top scorer with the most goals. It was like not a bitter, but it was a really good feeling to, you know, have done well that season under very, very difficult circumstances. You know, a lot of politics happening. Because as a manager, when you bring in big players on big wages and big fees, you have to play them. So a Crespo and a Adrian Mutu had to play. But then, you know, to win that battle and to play and still then become the top scorer while you has got less minutes than the others, you know, is satisfying personally, you know. And then at the end of the season, Ranieri gets sacked, Mourinho comes in, and I leave Chelsea without speaking to Mourinho or whoever.
So when you left Chelsea, I think you did Middlesbrough and Charlton and Cardiff, and I guess that saw in the end of your career, in end of your playing career anyway, in 2008.
Yeah,
I mean when you finished playing, I mean, I guess what made the decision to finish? But then, did you know immediately that you were going to go into coaching and management, or were you going to take a time out?
I took a time out. I didn't know yet that I was going to go into coaching. I didn't do my badges at that time.
Were you financially secure enough to never work again if you wanted to?
I was all right. I had made some investments that didn't work out. Some did, but I was okay. But I've always been somebody that wants to do something anyway. You know. I had small children then when I stopped in 2008. I took a year out where we traveled a lot as a family. We spent a lot of time together as a family and stuff. And after that year, I started to do my badges, speaking to Steve McLaren a lot, who I had as a coach at Middlesbrough, he advised me, Jim, just go and do your badges and have a look if you like it. Did a lot of coaching at Chelsea, where Neil Bart helped me out with the youth, with having X amount of players that I could coach with and stuff. Where Chelsea was just absolutely brilliant and giving me time to coach the youngsters. Then Steve McLaren became manager at Nottingham Forest. And he said, Jim, come and have a look. Come and spend some time with us. I did. And I liked it and seeing how he was working and stuff. And then a few weeks later, he asked me to be his first team coach, what came just out of the blue, you know? Didn't expect that. So I took it.
And anything that really sticks in your mind from either you as a player or from any of your managers before that you took with you to coaching and management, you know, I guess that either inspired you one way or the other?
I think you take a lot. Because they mold you in a good or bad. Yeah. Thinking back, you learn more from the bad than from the good. You know, you always have got a vision of how you want things anyway. In business or in football, it's all the same. Yeah. It's putting that vision in on paper and to deliver it to the individuals. And there is where that is where people get an opinion of you. How good do you deliver what you want, and how well do they understand it? And the delivery of Steve McLaren was very good. You know, as a coach, he's very one of the best I've seen. So for me to be around him when he's doing that, yes, very good. But then you're going to think about your other coaches, you know, that you've had, a Louis van Gaal or a Hiddink or a Jos Graham or a Ranieri or Gianluca Vialli or whoever, you know. And you're thinking, okay, he did that and that and that. Does that work for you? No. But you have to make things your own. You know, you cannot just take something from somebody else and replicate it, because it's not your own. You have to make things your own. I just found to use things and to invent things or to make things to my personality. You know,
what's the hardest thing about being a manager?
The hardest thing about being a manager is, there's a few of hard things, is making sure that the people above you stay with you.
People above you, as in the owners.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, working upwards.
Do they interfere? Well, I guess it depends.
It's not about interfering. It's about just making sure that you communicate. You keep communicating. You keep making them understand why, how, and when. You know? Those people have got a lot of people in their ear. A lot of people, and they're getting pulled left, right, and center. You need to make sure that you have got their ear and in the right way, and that they stay with you. And then there is the media, you know. That they stay with you. Yeah.
I'm going to read off my notes for this because I want to get this context and question right. But in 2014, the Port Vale chairman said he removed your name from consideration to be their manager, as he was worried about the racist elements of his club's fan base and that they'd abuse you. And earlier this year, a report by the Black Footballers Partnership revealed that 43% of Premier League footballers are black, but only 4.4% of managers in English football are black. Now, I know you've spoken about the fact that, I mean, you have an experienced racism and that you want to, and that you very much believe you've got your jobs on your merits, etc. I mean, can we maybe talk about that, put a bit of context around it?
Yeah, we can. The owner at Port Vale is a coward. At the time, I don't know his name, but I said that if somebody is the right person for the right job, doesn't matter what his background is. If he's the right person for the right job, then give him that job.
Just so I understand, did he tell you at the time he'd removed
no,
you,
or, he didn't.
Or you found out after the fact?
He didn't. He said that after I went to Burton Albion and I started doing really, really well. So then he needed to come up with an excuse because I was linked with that job, with Port Vale, and I didn't get it. So the fans gave him stick. Why did you not give Jimmy the job? So he came out. It's just an excuse. It's being a coward.
I mean, do you think the game's moving in the right direction to address the disparity between, you know, numbers of black players versus numbers of black managers?
The only thing that I can say is I have applied for a lot of jobs. Majority of jobs, I didn't get an interview. Why? I don't know. I can't tell you. I didn't get an interview. I only want to get a job because they think that I'm the right person for that job. And I do know that a lot of black ex-players don't want to go and take their badges because of they think that we don't get a chance. We don't get a fair chance. And if you look at the numbers, then you would say, yes, but it's not only about the numbers. What you also need to look at is how many black managers, qualified black managers are there? Or coaches, how many are there? And then you have to do the numbers. And then you need to have a look at how many of these black managers are applying for jobs and how many get interviewed. You know? Then you can make a real assumption.
So are we saying, forgive me if I'm misunderstanding, but are we saying that maybe to pitch 4.4% against 50% is almost like a sensationalized statistic for the sake of the press? And if we actually backwork this and say, well, hang on a minute, there's not even enough people taking the badges in the first place, which then means there's not enough people who are even able to be it. There's then not enough people who are good enough to be it. Does that make sense?
In a way, yes, but I want to know those facts first, mm-hmm, before I can give you the right answer. You know, I can only give you an answer of my experience. Yeah, and my experience is that I don't get interviewed. That's my experience. I was always told, Jimmy, start in League Two. Yeah. And then start small and then do well and then you will get an opportunity higher. Other players who are white, who has got a more or less a name like me or bigger, they don't have to do that. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, 100%.
So that is my fact.
Yeah, and Patrick Vieira would say the same. Thierry Henry would say the same. Sol Campbell will say the same. Those are their facts. You know? But the numbers, I can't tell you the exact numbers. You know? I've seen a podcast with Barnes. What's his name? Podcast with Barnes and the guy from TalkSport.
Simon Jordan.
Simon Jordan, yes. And in a way, I was intrigued, and it was about this subject, and I listened to it, and I'm feeling that Simon did not get what it was really about. And he went to say, I was the Crystal Palace owner, but I had no black managers applying for the job. Barnes said, yeah, because we think we would not get it anyway. And he is saying, yeah, but is that not wrong? I would have given somebody a chance. Mm-hmm. And then he starts talking about Jermaine Defoe. Jermaine Defoe says, I don't want to go and do my badges because I'm not going to get a fair chance anyway. So why do my badges? Simon Jordan said, that is wrong. That's not wrong. If you feel you're not going to get a chance in somewhere, you're not going to pursue that, would you? If you think,
I mean, I get what you're saying, and obviously as a white guy, it's more difficult for me to have a conversation.
But think,
if I don't put my hat in the ring.
Okay, but think somebody, think about something else. If you want to be this, you want to set up a company, a security company. But your company is not going to get any contracts. You know already your company is not going to get any contracts. Would you still set that up?
I mean, I don't know if this is a fair analogy. I'm trying to think.
It's not a fair analogy.
No, not what you've said. What okay. I'm about to say. I mean, yeah. I was going to say. So you know, I have a you know, let's say a colourful and you know, parts problematic past in business. You know, I've had a bankruptcy. Yeah. Had you know, some other insolvency events. And when it comes to things like the FCA,
yeah.
You know, I am very much persona non grata. Now, I guess I've got two choices, you know. I mean, if I go and talk to any mainstream person in compliance, in law, you know, they'll be saying, don't even attempt, you know, the FCA will not go anywhere near you. But then there's a lot of businesses that I want to do that need it. And I guess I've got two choices. You know, I can either say, well, fuck it, I'm not going to enter this market because they're never going to deal with a person like me. Or I can say, well, I'm going to put my best foot forward. I'm going to try what I can do. I might, you know, kick up a PR stink and tell people, you know, let the world know how wrong the FCA are for not giving me a chance 20 years later. But I'm going to try and I'm going to do my best because I actually do want to do it. I'm not going to let them tell me what I can't.
Yeah. Okay. But that is fine. But a lot of other people choose a different route, and I can understand that, you know, rightly or wrongly, I can understand that.
Why did you, but you didn't choose that route?
No, I didn't choose that route because I had Steve McLaren who said, Jim, come, and have a look what I do. And then he said, Jim, do you want to be my first team coach? He said, he asked me, and I said, yes. And then he helped me with my badges. And I got my badges. And then he was the one Yeah. He was the actually the one who called for me, the Port Vale chairman. Okay. And he was actually the one who put my name forward and said, you should speak to Jimmy Floyd Hasselbaink. And he never spoke to me, the chairman. And then when the Burton job came up, he was the one, Steve McLaren, that said to Ben Robinson, who's the owner of Burton Albion, you should actually speak to Jimmy. And they spoke to me and they liked what they saw. And I got the job. And I was a success at Burton. So that's a different way. And I want to be in it. I feel that there is a niche for me in the coaching or managerial or whatever world in football. So I can understand what Jermaine Defoe is saying, yeah, because it is difficult. But I am not that kind of person.
Sure.
Yeah, I'm a little bit what you are saying. I will still have a go. I'm still having a go. And I'm with England because, first of all, Garrett knows me from my Middlesbrough time and knows the person that I am. And he believes in me. And he gives me the chance to be with him and to help him. Black or white, he doesn't look at me like that. And I know that, you know, because I've played with him for 2 years. And he was always around everybody. He was with the white guys. He was with the black guys. He was joking with us. He was giving us stick. He was being tough on us, yeah, as a captain when he needed to be. Regardless of what background we are. You understand what I'm saying?
100%.
So now I'm working with the guy.
And do you consider people like Steve and Gareth to be mentors?
Steve Holland?
McLaren.
Well, I'm the same age more or less as Gareth. But Steve, yeah, definitely. You know? Definitely. You know, if you look at other ex managers, Tony Pulis or Big Sam, you know, they've had lots of black players playing for them, but I haven't seen them at the forefront of the black coaches' issues, you know. When they were managers themselves in the Premier League, they would always say, "Oh, all the top jobs are going to foreigners." And there were advocates. There were leaders in that way of trying to get English managers, those jobs. But I don't see them helping the black coaches. And I might be wrong here. Listen good to what I'm saying. I might be wrong. But I don't see them, you know, at the forefront of you know, helping the situation, getting more black coaches, not losing all that kind of experience, you know, and let that go out of the game. Because I know there's a lot of black managers that want to be coaches, but they have to put bread on the table as well. Mm-hmm. You know, they need to make a living, and they thinking, okay, I'm not gonna get an in. You know, I'm not gonna get an in. Why should I pursue this? You know, I need to do something that is going to feed my kids and get me successful. What people forget is, we also have wives at home that will say, hello, we need to eat. or hello, we need to pay the bills. You know, that doesn't change in white families or black families. That is, those dynamics are still the same, you know. So, but hopefully we can see more black managers or black coaches taking their badges first.
Sure.
You know? And then from there we can
see what happens.
You know, we can push it more.
Earlier this year you were appointed to the England men's team as a coach. Yeah. I mean, what's your remit and how did the role come about?
Very coincidental. I met Garrett and we started talking, and he asked me if I would join. Obviously, Garrett knows me. He was my captain at Middlesbrough. We played 2 years there. My last game with him was the final in the UEFA Cup, but we lost 4-0 against Seville. I love it. Really good group. And for me, myself, you know, I've worked in League Two, League One, as a manager, as a coach, as well in the Championship, as a manager in the Championship. I've worked with QPR, but with the FA, it's the top of the top, you know, working with the best talent in the country. Seeing them flying over the pitch and seeing that group together is magnificent, yes.
And I've heard that the St. George's Park training facility is something special.
Yeah, obviously, I know that really well already, because when I was at Burton, that was our training ground. And now, obviously, with the England team, it's the home where we always train, and the facilities are absolutely magnificent, and the pitches are very good, and it's a good hotel, and it's very important for the FA to have a base, obviously, you know, and yeah, it's a great spot.
We were talking about Mason Greenwood a little earlier, whether or not he's going to play again properly for Man U. I mean, what's your view on whether or not he could get a place in the England team again, and how much do you consider on pitch and off pitch behaviour and activities?
I don't know. I can't give you a lot of comment on that. I don't know a lot of the situation.
I mean, if you were picking a team, you know, would you pick someone that came with that baggage if they were a great player?
Oh, it depends. That is a very difficult question. The thing is, he needs to start playing again, hopefully, and then we can see from there. The picking is not up to me. I can't comment really on that. It's a situation that I don't know enough about for me to give you an answer on.
Let's talk a bit about money. I guess sort of money and football always go hand in hand. I mean, how financially motivated are you? I mean, I know, when you first started your career, you know, you felt like you've made it when you had £250 a week. Obviously, you know, times have changed dramatically since then. But I mean, how much has money been a motivator for you, and what does it mean?
Money is important. Money is very important. You love the game and you want to play the game, but there's an aspect of money with it, and you want to be paid as much as you can, like any other industry. What people forget is when you have signed your contract, you don't think about the money no more. You don't think about the contract meetings you play. until your time comes again to talk about it when your contract is almost finished. So, but you play, you play for playing football. I've never really, yeah, you think about the money, but as soon as that is gone, it's forgotten. You know, as soon as your contract meeting or contract has been signed, you're forgotten. You think about playing football and running after a ball.
I mean, who advised you about money over the years? I mean, I know you said you made some good investments, you made some bad investments. I mean, did you have a financial advisor? I mean, you know. Does someone look after the players?
Yeah, well, nowadays you have got players, have got so many more people around them and people to specialize in different areas, you know. So nowadays players are being looked after so much better. You know, in my time it was my agent and maybe one more. And really that's it. But nowadays, the players have got they're a lot smarter. The parents are a lot smarter, and they're being looked after so much better.
But other than learning how to kick a ball, what do you think the best financial decision you've ever made is?
The best financial decision I've ever made. Oof. I think buying a few properties.
I mean, property is a big part of your life, big part of your investment
yes,
strategy.
Yes, 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 yes. It is. I love it. Everywhere I went in football, I bought a flat or a house and done it up. And then when I left, I sold it again and made a little bit of profit or whatever, you know. Yeah, outside of football, I like to do a bit of property.
I mean, just for a bit of context, we're recording this in the middle of August, so we're a couple of weeks before the closing window of transfer season. I mean, what's transfer season like? You know, both for transfer day for a manager and a player. You know,
well, for a manager, it's it's a lot of work at the background, especially if you have to bring X amount of players in.
So, I mean, more particularly like deadline day.
Yeah. Well, obviously the manager will have made their plans, and deadline day, that's the day where you don't want to be doing any business, really. You know, so if you're still active on the deadline day, that means that the plan hasn't worked, yeah, and you haven't had your targets, or that you have had a late injury and you need somebody to cover, or you are in a bracket where you don't have a lot of money and you need to pick up what is left. So you don't really want to do business on that last day. But if you have to, you have to have really good nerves and waiting and be patient, and then trigger. And majority of the time, you don't get the player that you want. Even if you are patient, you have to be really lucky on the last day of the. Of the window. As a player, if you want to move, again, last day of that window is not the day for you to move. It's nerve-wracking. It is nerve-wracking.
And how important are agents? I mean, are they helpful or are they just, you know, blood suckers?
Good agents are very, very helpful, and normally good agents will not do a lot of business on the last day. It's all about planning, isn't it? It's all about knowing already your player wants to move and all that kind of stuff. Know the plan of the club, what the club wants, and where your player sits in the club. So look, like in all industries, you've got good agents, you've got bad agents, you've got good players, you've got bad players, you know, you've got good managers, you've got bad managers, you know. So it's no different with agents.
Look, we can't wrap up without talking about a little bit about the Saudi Arabian Football League and the insane amounts of money that are flying around over there. I mean, yeah, I guess two questions really. I mean, look, if you'd have had your day again, would you have liked to have seen out your career over there? And also, you know, what do you think about the younger guys who aren't finishing their career out there, but they're effectively, you know, giving up their prime of, you know, say Premiership League football to go and take the big bucks in Saudi?
Yeah. If you're asking me, would I go if I was 25, 26? I don't know. I can't tell you that, you know. Would I go if I was 32, 30, 31, 32, 33? I would have definitely.
Hell yeah.
Yeah, I would have definitely gone. Don't get me wrong. I went to Middlesbrough and I had two magnificent years and I end up playing in a UEFA Cup final. But the amount of money that is being thrown over there and being paid over there is massive. So yeah, I can understand why players say, okay, I'm gonna play there for 2-3 years, you know. And it's a different experience, it's a different way, it's a different pressure, it's a different living, you know. So yeah,
I mean, and do you think for the younger players who are playing out there, it's going to hamper their chances of being called up for their country again, you know, just not being able to play at a high enough level?
Well, we don't know. We don't know. It all depends, isn't it? It's I don't know the level of it, but it all depends what players they are and who else are their competition, you know, and all that kind of stuff.
Well, listen, I mean, it's been great having you here. And
thank you.
I've got to ask you before you go, I guess, look, 15 plus years of football career, you know, 15 plus years of business career since then. If you had to look back at, you know, little Jimmy, the being a gangster on the streets.
No, gangster is very hard. It's very, wasn't, I was
a naughty teenager.
I was a little shit. That's what I was. Yeah.
Okay, Jimmy the little shit. If you had to look back and advise yourself about what, you know, what success would look like to you, do you think your view of success has changed?
Yes and no. Look, I've had a difficult youth, but it was a majority my fault. I must say I've turned out okay. I see myself as a really good guy. So in that aspect, I've learned a lot and I know what kind of person I am and I'm a good guy. Forget about football. Forget about football. I am a genuine guy who can work with a lot of people from different backgrounds. I'm open. I'm honest. I see myself as a good bloke, you know. So I've turned out okay.
So you're a GB. I had James Gaskell, the rugby player, on a couple of days ago, and we were talking a similar question, and he gave a similar answer, but he described himself as a GC, which is a good cunt. So.
Well, I can't be. Of course, I can be a dick if I need to be a dick, you know. But that's not how I go out of the door or wake up, you know. I want to live my life in the right way. I want to be successful. I'm ambitious, but I'm not ambitious that I'm gonna step on people, you know. I've got I've got codes, you know, and I want to work with people. I want to be around people, and I also want to be an example for other people, you know. I'm trying to be positive, you know.
Cool. Well, listen, Jimmy, it's been a pleasure, and even as someone who knows nothing about football, I've very much enjoyed the last couple of hours, and I hope we get to do it again sometime.
Cheers. Yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.